Married with Children, the podcast, hosted by Dustin and Callie. Follow us on social media, on Twitter, @Married_Show, Facebook, Married with Children Show, on Instagram, Married with Children Show, or reach out to us in an email, marriedwithchildrenshow@gmail.com. We're always looking for guests and sponsors. If you have a name of a guest that would be an interesting interview on the Married with Children Show, please send that information to us through social media or straight to our email address. Also, if you have a small business that you'd be interested in being a sponsor on the show, please reach out to us through an email so that we can work out a way that best suits you and our listeners. Also, if you like the podcast, be willing to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Welcome back to the Married with Children podcast. Very exciting day today. We've got two of the candidates for the Indiana House of Representatives out of District 69. With us right now is Nancy Franke. Welcome, Nancy.
Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we are excited to kind of hear your take on things. And again, we're going to have Jim with us a little later to get his take, and it should be an exciting day. So, Callie, how are you?
Not bad. I'm really excited. I think this is going to be cool. We've never done a podcast like this one before, so
it's new for us,
so we're looking forward to it.
It's our first jump into the political realm, for sure.
Yeah, political for sure, yeah.
So, Nancy, tell us a little bit just about kind of your backstory and you know, why you chose to run for office.
Okay, well, I've never been one for getting involved with politics so much. I'm always interested on the side, but it started probably 8 years ago when I ran for the school board for Seymour Schools. And the reason I ran was because I saw we needed to have a change in the dynamics of our school corporation, and I wanted to serve and make a difference. I didn't have an agenda except for let's improve what we have and make things better for our children. And as I continued serving on the school board, I realized a lot of items that needed to be taken care of at the local level couldn't because of the hands that were tied at the state level. And as we talked more throughout education, we realized someone needs to be the voice at the state level to make those changes. And it's not just about education. I mean, we really have a lot of aspects within our community that needs to be addressed. The drug opioid epidemic, especially in the last few years, has been just mind-boggling and life-changing for a lot of people. We need to address those issues. I've also talked with others about the tax reform issues. Property taxes continue to raise, and we do not have a way to have control of that at the local level, and I think those things need to be addressed at the state level as well. I've always had a servant heart, and I just want to be a part of improving our communities.
Now, you teach, correct?
Correct. I'm a teacher at St. Peter's in Columbus.
And served on a school board, so mm-hmm. you have a lot of educational background
right
there. So I know that education is a big issue for you, and both of us are actually educators. Mm-hmm. And when we look at right now kind of the idea of the realm of education, teacher recruitment and teacher retention is horrible.
Oh, yes, and it's getting worse.
Absolutely. Yeah. So how do you think if you are elected, how do you think you can help with teacher recruitment and retention?
You know, this started back in 2010 when the state took over divvying out our taxes to the schools and making the assumption of how much each school was going to receive per student. Taking that control away from the local authorities started the mess. Our education environment is just toxic right now. Teachers are frustrated. More and more responsibilities are placed on them. We have anxiety within not just the teachers, but within the administration. It's almost like this environment has been created to pit each other against one another.
I would agree. Yeah,
and that's not how it used to be.
Right.
And even I'm a parochial school teacher. I started 26 years ago. When I started teaching, we had a wonderful relationship with our community schools. It wasn't one versus the other. But I think as our nation and as our state keeps continuing to shift towards this business model, that's what's tearing apart our schools and our communities.
You're constantly, you feel like you're competing.
Correct.
Constantly. So, I mean, you're constantly competing against, like you said, other local schools or, I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah. And the ones who are suffering are our children.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've never seen so much anxiety and stress levels at an elementary age like I have today. Right. It just continues to get worse. 2 years ago when I ran on a very grassroots effort, I thought, well, certainly it can't get any worse than it is right now. Wrong.
Yeah.
2 years later, it's even worse than before, and we just need to get a handle on this.
And I think the scary thing is that kids are being encouraged, students are being encouraged to not go into education. And
I
say this all the time. If I was an older teacher that my kids are already through, I can understand you trying to have that perspective. But we have a 3-year-old and one on the way. So for me, I need the best of the best going into education. Yeah.
Exactly. I see outstanding teachers leaving because, well, for various reasons, but like I said, it comes right down to the environment of the classroom, of the schools, of the politics that are being played into it that no one signed up for to begin with.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the standardized testing, I realize there's a control level at the federal level. Well, instead of just throwing up our hands and saying, well, we can't do anything about it, the feds have control, get ourselves over there to D.C. and talk to the people who need to make those changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what I plan to do this summer, actually. Well, my husband and I were going to go to D.C. over spring break, but we had to postpone plans because of this campaign. but we decided this summer we're going to make efforts to get over to D.C. I've already been in contact with several people in the D.C. office to say, hey, this summer I'd like to meet with you because you need to do your part at the federal level so we can do our part at the state level.
Right. Well, because then, I mean, obviously, like you said, your hands are tied at the local level because of, I mean, it just keeps going up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think people realize the tie-in, because another one of your major issues on your website is, you know, the manufacturing here and the advanced manufacturing. We have students. I work at Jennings County High School, and we have students that are perfect candidates for that, but get caught in this testing, remediation, testing, remediation. So our ability to get them with hands-on opportunities is almost impossible.
Right. Seymour Schools, we have almost 200 students in work-based learning programs this year.
Right.
And the sad thing is, if we send too many students into the work-based program right after graduation, Seymour Schools get docked. I just had a conversation with a constituent today when I was going door to door. If a school sends more students towards the workplace, or I should take that back. If your rate of how many students you send off to college goes down, you get docked points. That's why Seymour Schools can rarely ever get an A accountability rating.
Right.
With the formula, the way it's set up, you know, schools like Trinity, fine school, most of their students head off to college.
Right.
So it's so easy for them to get the A accountability
score. They're
getting
those points
and
for that.
Four stars. Our other schools, we're working towards helping our students walk into a field that's best for them, but the majority, it's not for college.
Right.
And so now our schools get docked and we get these lower grades, if you want to call it that. And it's not because the schools aren't successful. It's because the formula has been corrupt and it needs to be reformulated.
And we have employers out there with great jobs begging for these kids.
Yes, begging. Absolutely.
Yeah.
They just want kids who have some of those skills in advanced manufacturing that'll work hard, that have you know the soft skills, professional skills to come in and do the right thing. And they're begging for them, for high-paying, good jobs.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I think a lot in the community also don't realize things like classes we had before, like industrial arts and home ec, We have those courses, but they are the tech advanced courses mm-hmm. that the manufacturers are looking for.
Right.
And we are training them. We just don't call them industrial arts anymore.
Right.
There are other higher tech names for that, but it's the same idea. And we are trying to prepare students for that, for going into those fields. We just need to take away the stigma of the idea that a student has to go on to college right after high school.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing is that's not for everybody.
No.
And I mean, like, I'm a high school teacher, and so it's like, I can see some of these kids that they would be, I mean, they're going to be so successful in some of those manufacturing fields mm-hmm. to where they're not meant to go to college, and that's fine. I mean, they're going to do and be very successful with any of that.
Absolutely.
And I love what you just said, and I had this conversation the other day, because I'm in school administration, and one of my areas, my departments to evaluate is our tech department.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a conversation with those guys, and I said, you know, when I was in my industrial tech classes, and no knock on them, I turned a bowl on the lathe, and I made a clock, a mm-hmm. wood clock. I walk in today, we've got one class that's building a full tiny house, wiring it, you know, plumbing it, putting the entire tiny house together. We've got another group, I walk in, they're printing things on 3D printers. Another one is building electric go-karts that they're going to race at the Indy Motor Speedway. And I'm just like, if this had been available, I don't know that I would have... And I love my job, love right. education, not knocking it. Mm-hmm. But I would have taken a lot harder look at some of this stuff, because this is amazing right. what these guys are doing.
Absolutely. And it's actually one of our hidden gems with the schools. Like, we need to get that message out there. I don't think many people realize mm-hmm. just what great aspects our schools are doing for our students. Yeah. My son, he's in the work-based learning program and works over at Excel Manufacturing. And it really has opened his eyes of what he can do later on. He's planning to head up to Fort Wayne, take some advanced classes so he can get into digital technology mm-hmm. and right. digital engineering. But it started with these work-based learning programs to expose them to a whole new field of ideas that he did not realize before.
And a lot of employers will actually, for a lot of kids, if they get them in the door, they'll send them and pay them for them to go
yeah.
and get that extra
That's
education.
Right. You are correct. Absolutely.
And there is. There is a stigma about those trades. There's a stigma. And, mm-hmm. and you know, one of the employers there in Jennings County that I visited the other day, my father retired from General Motors and worked in foundries, and I remember going and visiting there, and they were dirty, they were hot, they were loud, they were, and when I walk in this tool and die, it's cool. Mm-hmm. You can have a conversation. It's quiet. It's not dirty. Guys aren't, you know, breaking their back. They're working with machines mm-hmm. and so the whole field has changed from what I saw my dad do in manufacturing, you know, for 30 years to what it is today. And that stigma really has to come off of right. those things.
And I know Governor Holcomb has been pushing for Indiana to be number one in manufacturing. We need to do our part to help keep it that way. And what I'd like to do is take that to the State House, what I see within our education field and what we can do to make this happen.
Very cool. You brought up the drug epidemic, which is obvious. I mean, especially in our area here, we've seen a lot of, you know, families struggle with that, and families from all different socioeconomics that deal with the opioid epidemic mm-hmm. and the heroin epidemic. And, you know, where do you think your candidacy, and if you're elected to the State House, where do you think you can help with that?
Well, I've already built up a great rapport and networking with the state on this very subject. And Governor Holcomb actually has sent Jim McClellan and several others from his state office to come down to Jackson County to speak with the Jackson County Drug Free Council. I'm on the council now as a board member. We need to make sure the state remembers that this area needs help just as much as Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Gary, and some of those larger cities. We need to address the addiction and the treatment for it, just like any other addiction. There's a lot of different aspects in how to treat it. There's not one great answer for it. But I do believe a treatment center, other avenues that we can help reach those who are fighting the addiction will be so needed in this area, and that's something I'm going to be pushing for. There's no one way to do this because everyone's wired differently. Mm-hmm. I know this personally because my parents adopted my younger sister, who has been dealing with addiction all her life, and it's going to be a lifelong struggle. She will never be able to kick that feeling of her desire for
right.
that drug because of what she has done to her body. The funny thing was, it started with marijuana and moved to the harder drugs. She's doing well right now, but she said it's there every single minute, every hour of the day. She has to continue with counseling, with other treatment options to remind her how important it is to stay away from that and to fight that. On the other extreme, we have my elderly mother who is 85 years old. And years back, her doctor back in Iowa loaded her up with pain medicine to deal with her pains that she had with back surgery and hip surgery and all that. And she was on that for 5 years. We moved her to be closer to us so we could help her. And the local doctor that she has now, we took her off of all that. But her body still craves that addiction or the opioids. Mm-hmm. And so we've been also working with different counselors, with healthcare professionals to help her through this, because I tell you, when she was on it, it was horrible, absolutely horrible, and it impacted the entire family. And sadly, she lost her entire financial, how do I want to say that? Her
stability.
Yeah, her stability. So we're the ones who now are taking care of her, making sure she manages things, making sure her medication is managed, making sure her health care team is working with her. I can't imagine what other families are going through.
Well, I think that's interesting just hearing that from you. So, I mean, mm-hmm. like, you've got kind of a personal...
Right.
Story, and you understand what some of these other, mm-hmm. Families may be going through. And I think that's interesting others to know that, I mean, it's not just you saying, well, it's bad. You've been through it in different aspects.
And
so.
We had to move from the stigma of, oh, you don't talk about this. This is our family's hidden secret.
Absolutely.
I believe that. Yeah.
But we're never going to be able to address the issue for the communities if we keep doing that.
And I think it's interesting, too, and I'll be honest, I'm probably one that never thought about it as much with the elderly and mm-hmm. the senior citizens, and it's so true because they're not the ones that we see on the front page of the paper
right.
because of an overdose or mm-hmm. because of, and probably, too, we probably naturally just think, hey, they need this more because of the pain. And I think that's a great point of we've got some of them that are suffering with this same mm-hmm. addiction because of what these opioids are doing to them.
Correct. And I know at the state level, they've been talking about CBD oils, medical marijuana. I think there may be a place for that in some avenues. I don't think it's the sure cure fix all for every single mm-hmm. person, but I am glad that they are going to be addressing that in the summer study. And that might be under the guidance of a doctor, might be a option for some people. Again, I think that's there's other options out there for others that are dealing with it, and each person is different.
So would medical cannabis be something you would support, because it is a hot topic issue right now?
It is. I would support it with the idea that we have regulation. As much as I know I'm a Republican and I'm talking regulation, what kind of combination is that? But this is a serious piece that if we let it go haywire, it would go out of control, and we don't want that for our communities or our state. But I do believe there's some great sense in that. Also, I've been discussing with a professor from IU. There's also some others that they're on the brink of new pain medication using the THC without the high that mm-hmm. someone would get.
Right.
And I don't think we're very far away. I mean, months, if not just a year or two away from that. And I think that would, we should seriously give that some consideration as well.
All right, very cool. And I think I appreciate the way that you kind of go about that, because you, all of this is gray. There is no right. black and white. And no matter how much we want to say that, you know, I'm on this side, there's gray. And I appreciate that about you, because it's, even if you say, yes, we're going to vote for medical marijuana, you have to have that backup of how are we going to regulate it? Because, correct. And I've, right. obviously I've never lived in California. They've had it forever, but I know the stereotype or stigma is that it was a joke. You walk in and say, I get headaches, and you get your card. You know, I think it's important that if that's something we do it the right way.
Exactly. Exactly. And I know, and my son has given me permission to talk about this. He has epilepsy. He's had seizures. I understand what it does to a parent watching your child go through a seizure, where in my son's case, it's just once every once in a while. But for a parent to have their child going through seizures daily, if not several times a day,
right.
I appreciate they have that medical option with the CBD oils right now. And again, there probably will be a definite proof and advantages for them in use of medical marijuana. No parent wants to see their child going through that each and every single day.
Right.
And
right.
the toll it takes on their body is just incredible.
And again, if there's something that can help that case under the idea of a doctor, and, you know, under the guidance of a doctor, I think that's, it's huge to have that option for
absolutely.
Those parents.
Absolutely.
Well, also, you know, I think you have a very interesting story, and you kind of led to it with your sister a little bit, but, you know, you are pro-life, obviously, and you have an interesting kind of story for why.
Well, probably because my birth mother had the opportunity, well, I definitely not the opportunity, the choice to either keep me or abort me, because she was a single mom raising a four-year-old at the time and wasn't married. And at that time, 50 years ago, it would have been just again, the stigma of, oh my goodness, she's pregnant. What kind of a horrible person is she? She chose life. And she chose to still go through the birth, and she put me up for adoption. And I was adopted by two parents who were deaf, by the way. And,
really?
Yes, and they were never able to have children, and they adopted me. So that's what started the path of, if my birth mother did not give me that opportunity to have life, I wouldn't be here today. Another part of the story was of our daughter, Rachel. When I was carrying her, things were showing up on the ultrasound that just showed there's probably going to be some concerns with her. We didn't know at what point. And for some reason, the doctor that I had, I was up in northern Wisconsin at the time, the doctor quickly suggested, well, you can always abort and not go through this pregnancy. I remember just standing up off the table and said, absolutely not. This is not an option. Rachel definitely has her struggles. We now know afterwards, you know, after the birth, she's on that autism spectrum. And, you know, even as a baby, she went through a lot of issues with not only colic, but strange times of lethargic. That we just had no explanation for. Boy, but to think if I had listened to the doctor to say, yeah, we might, you know, might have some problems, let's end it now. We'd never have Rachel. And I value life so much. It's part of my Christian makeup and the beliefs that we have about promoting life and protecting life. And that will always be a part of who I am. I do understand where women have shared, well, what happens in a situation where it's your life versus the unborn child's life? And I do not envy anyone having to go through a decision like that. I'm not one that's going to pass judgment. And my husband and I, our decision as parents have always been, if it ever came down to that, we're going to let God handle this. But I'm not going to interfere with what they are going through and what their doctors are telling them. But boy, I would hope that they look at choosing life. There's some tough situations out there. But I know some pro-life groups have asked me, where do you stand on some of these bills that are coming through? And I definitely will be supporting those pro-life bills.
Another big topic right now is obviously gun rights, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, again, going back to your educational background, to kind of pair that with school safety.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of talk about where you stand on those things.
Wow, that's been a hot topic for the last 6 months.
Yes.
Absolutely. As a school board member, we have had several executive meetings regarding solely that topic. You know, bless the hearts of those who think the easiest solution is just let teachers carry. And it seems on paper in black and white, yeah, that would make sense. But the reality is there are so many other dynamics we have to consider. Number one, insurance companies are going to tell you your liability insurance is going to be raised per teacher that you have.
Mm-hmm.
We also have situations where, well, how do you decide who gets to and who doesn't, and who do you offend through this whole process? And we've also have teachers who said, you know what, I'm not going to be in a building where teachers are carrying. I'm out of here. So you got to find that balance. Just the other day we had another meeting on school safety issues. It will come out, the results of a survey will come out in a few weeks, but I can tell you one thing. One aspect of the survey asked teachers and others on staff, what would you prefer within the building? Vast majority like the idea of an SRO, mm-hmm. which we have several SROs in our Seymour schools. Only 4% said they would support the option of teachers carrying. So this discussion of, all the teachers want to carry, absolutely false. Absolutely false. I know as an educator myself, I walk through my day each day wondering, okay, if we were under active shooter drill or active shooter right now, what's going to happen? How effective am I going to be? I would say 97-98% of the time would not be effective because of where I'm at in relation to my students, or within the hallway, crowded hallways, crowded right. lunchrooms. I just would not be effective. Thankfully, we have many people within the law enforcement offices that make their rounds at our schools. Everyone's gone through their safety training. We do all of our measures to make sure our schools are as safe as possible. And I know that's true for every school out there. Do we really want our children to live in a school setting where we have everyone carrying all the time?
And I'll be honest, I was probably on the other side until last summer. Mm-hmm. I probably leaned more towards, you know, some kind of selection of people. And again, mm-hmm. I understand how do you offend, and, you know, having them go through some training. But I got the opportunity to actually train with the North Vernon Police Department mm-hmm. when they did one of their active attacker drills. And I played the part of just kind of a teacher or mm-hmm. a student who was going to come around the corner and confront the officers coming in to kind of yell at them and just, you know, right. kind of frantic. Out of two of the scenarios, I was shot twice.
Hmm.
And so both times, as I came around the corner yelling, their immediate reaction was to shoot. And that's not a knock on the law enforcement whatsoever.
Right.
But it opened my eyes to, this is what these guys do every day. They right. train for
they train
hours
for this.
And hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't make it. And even in that situation where they're not really feeling the adrenaline and threat because
right.
it's not real, mm-hmm. it's a training, they made that mistake twice.
Yes.
And I just thought, I couldn't do that. As an educator, that's not what I'm trained to do. And
mm-hmm.
and I'm a gun supporter. I
Absolutely.
Own guns.
Same way.
But I'm not trained to go into a building right. and do that.
My campaign manager is on the Seymour Police Force. He used to be a teacher at the middle school. And he shares with me the reality of the tactical force behind what their training is and the percentage of getting an accurate shot when you're in that type of situation. And he's one that's trains consistently. He's also in the reserves with the military. He knows what he's talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if he even says, I can't get an accurate shot, how in the world are we expecting the civilians, our teachers, who are not training as much as he is?
Right. I mean, because even if you just say you're just going to, I mean, that teacher has to go through a certain training, you know, mm-hmm. like even if you say like every single summer they have to, yeah, I mean, like right. that's not the kind of training like you guys talk about with the police department that they do, you know, mm-hmm. almost on a daily basis.
Right. A few years ago, I was part of a meeting where they brought in one of the gun safe boxes mm-hmm. and to help convince some of us on the school board to consider this option. And I looked at several who were promoting this and I said, you don't work with sixth graders very often, do you? And they're like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, all I have to do is I just step out of the hall to deal with a situation, and I have the rest of my sixth graders in the classroom by themselves. Normally, you would hope they're going to settle down. It doesn't always happen. It doesn't take much for someone to come over and run their fingers across to figure out the finger code for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, that'll never happen. They could never figure it out. And right. I went up and did that. Second time around, the door popped open just by fluttering my fingers across like a sixth grader would.
Right, right.
Right then and there, I said, no. I know my sixth graders well enough. There's going to be an ornery one that's going to try to do something.
Yeah.
And actually, I've read articles where some of those safe boxes, all you need is a little pin to pick at the back and you can open it.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my concern, too, with it is because, you know, our ultimate goal in education is to keep firearms out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you put in, I think it just opens up the greater chance to get one in a student's hand.
Correct.
So, you know, I hope that the state of Indiana, and they've done a great job, is I'm a mm-hmm. you know, certified school safety specialist, and I've been to the trainings, and I hope that that continues because I think it's been done great things for our mm-hmm. our schools, and the, you know, we are training better now than ever, we are more vigilant now than ever, but I don't think and agree with you, I think if we're going to put money into training and things somewhere, it needs to be to supply more school resource officers
right,
in our buildings,
right, and I've been proud of our Seymour schools, the safety team that's in place there. We've used grant monies to not only fund our resource officers, but also to set safety barriers throughout every one of our buildings. And I feel confident that we have made them as safe as possible in mm-hmm. the most logical, sensible way. I know the state is also considering some more grant money or other funds to provide for school safety, and I'm also all for that. I'd love to see a few more resource officers in our buildings. And what a great way for our officers to build up a needed rapport with our students.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not just for safety issues, but with our drug and opioid epidemic, our officers, they're building up relationships with kids who are dealing with that at the home front. And the kids know, hey, these officers are here to help us, all right, not to get us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and with the, you know, our SAD program, well, new names now for the SAD program, but the drunk driving with other issues, I've been so proud of our resource officers and the skills that they've used to develop those positive relationships with our students. And that just makes us a stronger community.
Absolutely. And you know, something I've always said when it comes to school safety, when you talk about, you know, elementary schools, you could truly lock them down to a point that they're extremely safe because mm-hmm. most of the threats at an elementary level are on the outside.
Right.
It's an angry parent coming in. It's mm-hmm. a custodial issue. It's, you know, but when it comes to high school, most of the threat, and middle school, most mm-hmm. of the threat walks in every day.
Yep.
Looks just like everybody else.
Right.
You know, and it's, for me, it's about us connecting to our kids more and building relationships and knowing them and knowing when those mm-hmm. struggles are coming than making it a prison and locking it down. Right. Because in communities like Seymour, Jennings County, you know, Scottsburg, Brownstown, those schools are not just schools. They're community centers. Mm-hmm. A lot of us right. don't have YMCAs and these right. boys and girls. The high school is the community center. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just went through basketball season. Seymour had 8,000 people walking in there every other mm-hmm. week, every mm-hmm. weekend. Right. I mean, you can't put in metal detectors and having somebody mm-hmm. walk through and scan all that every time, because that's a great asset that this community has and mm-hmm. a great opportunity to bring people in and showcase what right. they have.
And it's a fact that we've actually deterred several possible situations simply because students had a relationship and a great rapport with the SROs and let them know, hey, there's a student who's saying this on social media. We're a bit concerned. They were able to address the issue and turn things around before it could even make it to a point where we would be on lockdown. So, again, more reason why we need to build those relationships.
Well, we are at about 35 minutes, Nancy, and
that was quick.
I want to say more than anything, thank you for coming on, but I want to give you one more chance, and I just want to say, for those voters that are headed to the ballot box on May 8th, why should they choose Nancy Franke?
I believe the people in our district need a new voice at the State House. I think a lot of us are over divisiveness. We want to get things done for us. And what hasn't happened, I think, just needs a new approach. And that's where I'm at. I still am a conservative Republican. I value all the ideals that our district has. I want to present us in a different way and make sure we are heard and that we get things done.
And I will tell you this. I really appreciate the chance to sit down and talk with you. I like your perspective. You have a lot of personal experience with what you stand behind, and I appreciate that, because a lot of people, I think, jump on those hot button issues just mm-hmm. because it's what people are talking about, but you have a lot of personal, you know, experience with where you're coming from. So,
well, I thank you both again for inviting me. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I agree totally with him. I think it was awesome, and hopefully you know, those locally that are voting and things can at mm-hmm. least be able to hear and like you said, hear some of those stories and why you feel, you know, and believe the way you do with some of those different hot topics. So I think that's great.
Thank you, and I appreciate you giving me the time to speak.
Absolutely. All right, thank you. Welcome back to the two-part Married with Children podcast special. Obviously, earlier we got the chance to sit down with Nancy Franke and talk to her a little bit. Now, in studio, we have Jim Lucas, current incumbent House of Representatives member from District 69, running for re-election. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Dustin, Callie, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
We're really excited to kind of hear a little bit more about Jim and what he's working towards. And we got a little chance to talk to him prior to turning the mics on, and we're really excited. So, Jim, I want to kind of start off with giving you the chance. Tell us, who is Jim Lucas? What's the backstory there?
Jim Lucas, just your average Jim, born and raised in Seymour, Indiana. Graduated from Seymour High School. After high school, joined the Marine Corps, went on and served there. Came back to live in Seymour. Eventually started my own business. And I've been small business owner for 19 years. And been married for 23 to my wonderful wife, Lynn. We have three children, Suzanne, Jack, and Madeline. And then two grandchildren, Clark and Freddie. Two dogs, Vinny and Harvey. And a pretty simple life, really.
You've got the perfect John Mellencamp small town life right there, coming from Seymour, Indiana.
Again, it's a real simple life. You know, I love this state, and especially Southern Indiana, living here. Like I said, you know, born and raised here. I've been out, but come back, and it's just, this is where my roots are.
Where all, you know, as you served in the Marine Corps, where all did you actually, where were you stationed? Where all did you serve?
Well, that's the funny part. I went in 0311, which is Marine Corps Infantry, and I like to joke, especially with other veterans and people who are currently serving. That's one of the things. We have kind of a warped sense of humor. I tell people that there are two parts to the U.S. military. There's Marine Corps Infantry, then there's support for Marine Corps Infantry. So I did very well in boot camp, graduated top of my class, got honor man, and that was kind of a curse because that sent me, because of that, I was sent to Marine Barracks 8th and I in Washington, D.C., and served on the silent drill team and the Presidential Honor Guard, which sounds really cool, and it was really cool, but after about the third year, it wasn't as cool as what the first year was. To me, the Marine Corps was more than that, and that's why I just served the one tour and then came back. But while I was in there, I had a lot of fun. It was really neat.
I was going to say, it sounds really cool, but it also sounds like something that could be pretty daunting and, you know, a lot of responsibility there.
Well, it wasn't that. It just, that's not what I signed up for. I wanted to be out in the trenches, you know, and blowing up things. And you can't really blow things up in the middle of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it wasn't the right location, yeah.
That usually causes a lot of your brothers to show up in Washington, D.C. Yeah. But, Jim, now, how many terms have you served as House of Representatives?
Currently serve three, running for a fourth, okay. Which primaries are coming up a little more than a week from now.
Yeah. Right.
So we'll see, you know, if the people like what I've been doing, hopefully I'll get sent up for a fourth term.
And this will come out on this Tuesday.
Right.
Yes. So May 1st. So it'll be a week right before the primaries come in.
Yes.
And so it'll be an opportunity for everybody to, you know, take a listen to everybody that's going to be involved. But, Jim, as you look at those three terms, what are the major accomplishments you're really proud of that you've accomplished while in office?
Well, probably the signature thing was my first year there. Jackson County came to me with a bill. There was an oversight on the county level where a tax bill had sunsetted. And this was also Governor Pence's first term, and he was very anti-tax. Well, here I bring this bill my first year as a legislator that reinstated this tax for the county level, which had we not gotten it passed would have cost the county about $750,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
And we got that passed, and the governor vetoed it. So we came back on special session, for not just for that, but for some other things. But we overrode the governor's veto for my first bill, and I'm thinking, wow, this is pretty incredible. You know, what a first year. Also, that first year, I got national recognition. I carried an amendment that we passed out of committee that required every Indiana school to have an armed person in it.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that came out of committee, I was grabbed by our press person and sat down, and she just started grilling me relentlessly because her phone was ringing off the hook from New York, L.A., people all across the country. We were the first state in the nation to do that. Well, that was one of the things. I think it caught so much attention so fast that they dialed it down a little bit from people above me that have more horsepower than what I did at that time. So that was a pretty interesting first year.
Wow, yeah.
But some of the other signature things that you've talked about, leading, not gaining just state recognition, but national recognition as well, are gun rights. To me, the Constitution means what it says as written. So I've gained quite the reputation there, NRA, Gun Owners of America, Second Amendment Foundation. I have worked with them quite a bit. Not just that, but it's the right thing to do. You know, that Constitution was written in such plain language that the everyday person could understand their rights. You know, and that was on intention. So the Founding Fathers wanted us to know what our rights were. And again, I'm a very avid believer in those. Two other issues that have gained quite a bit of attention is the industrial hemp issue, which we saw that Senator McConnell from Kentucky is fast-tracking a bill right now to take hemp off of Schedule 1 and start treating it like any other crop. And I had a bill last year that was recognized nationally as one of the best pieces of hemp legislation in America because of its simplicity and what it did and what it allowed. But we got that through the House unanimously, went over to the Senate, got it going through committee, and then the governor come in and kind of wanted to slow things down a little bit there. But also last year, I took on the medical cannabis issue, and that surprised me, the attention that got just it seemed to explode. And as we were talking, you know, before the podcast started, the attention that issue got, I think it's just the right timing for Indiana to start down that path. And, you know, to me, it's not a question of if Indiana adopts medical cannabis, but when. And,
right.
And for me, it's the sooner the better. So those are three major issues that I've gained, you know, recognition for being a leader on. I'm proud of that.
Let's talk about a few of those a little more in depth, and let's go right off with the Second Amendment and gun rights. Myself, I'm an NRA member. I'm a gun advocate. But, you know, with obviously the nation right now, major hot button issue and in the news is the idea of where is that line drawn? So for you, and I know you say that it's very simple, where is that line drawn on what should be available to the everyday person and what shouldn't?
Arms, whatever we can carry. When you look at when the Second Amendment was written by the Founding Fathers, I believe when they wrote that, you can go back and you can study the writings of each individual. You know, they were just coming off an ass-kicking of Great Britain by basically farmers and peasants. And they knew the importance of being able to take on a tyrannical, oppressive government. So that was, you know, the Second Amendment. It was put up to the top for a reason. It wasn't written with the type of, you know, firearms in mind. It was written for the type of government that we had. And look at our own state constitution, Article 1, Section 32. You know, the people shall have a right to bear arms for defense of themselves, period. There's no qualifiers there. No licensing mentioning, or, you know, one could discuss age limits, but society has adopted 18 as being, you know, an adult. So there's a compromise for me is okay, 18 to carry. But other than that, gun-free zones, we are seeing tragically all too often, gun-free zones are simply areas where people that obey gun laws are made easy victims for people that don't obey gun laws. You know, take schools, for instance. I mean, horrible. We can pray that never happens again. But when we see society deteriorating the way it is, you know, with drugs, with crime, and the assault on, you know, family and the breakdown of the family and the values that go with that, you know, personal responsibility, work ethic, characters, values, bad things are going to continue to happen. And making good people defenseless, to me, it's as immoral as it is wrong. And as a legislator, you know, one of the things I ask people constantly, you know, I make laws. Please, I beg you, bring me a law that will stop people who don't obey laws. But until then, we have to quit making innocent people defenseless, you know, in front of these people.
And let me ask you this just to kind of expound on that, because I know it's also a federal conversation right now with, you know, the ideas of like bump stocks and, you know, high capacity magazines and things like that. Where do you stand with that? Those aftermarket accessories that go on some of these firearms, you know, is that somewhere where you see regulation, or you still see, hey, it's an arm and we need to let the people have it?
Hold up your thumbs. Okay. Your thumbs are, they're held up. There's your bump stock. Okay. You put your thumb through the trigger guard, hook it in your belt loop. You can do the same thing. Okay. Now, bump stock, people committed to murdering children, do they care if we have a bump stock law or not? Or anybody out in the open?
Right.
You know, high capacity magazines. To me, that's dangerous because, again, the people that think nothing about murdering another human being, they could care less about your mag limit. But you criminalize an innocent law-abiding person. You've taken away one of their best means of self-defense against something that we're reading about all too often, home invasion. By not just one, you know, invader, but multiple invaders. So that right there, that's a crime.
Right.
Hey, now, hold people accountable for their actions. You know, how often do we, you know, hear on the radio or see on the TV or read in the newspaper people that are released early, you know, that have multiple strings of prior convictions, okay, they're out again, or one of the most dismissed or pled down charges are gun crimes. So why are we criminalizing innocent people with laws that they're not stopping anything?
Right.
And, you know, let's rely on facts here. One of the sayings I have, I love saying this, we have truth, facts, reason, and logic versus guilt, fear, deceit, and intimidation. You know, the facts. actually gun crimes have decreased by almost 50% in the last 20 years. Okay, now that is even as gun sales have just literally exploded. They've gone through the roof. And, you know, there's an estimated 350 to 400 million firearms in America, 100 million gun owners. Okay, now when you look at that, the actual facts, and I want to preface this, every death is tragic. But when you look at deaths by firearms, you know, in America, there's 325 million people, 2.6 million deaths on average per year. Okay, firearms are around 11 or 12,000 of that. Now, people were talking high-capacity magazines. I would assume we're talking about the scary AR rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the FBI shows in 2016, there were 374 people killed with rifles. Okay, again, every death being tragic, but compare that, you know, there were more than twice as many people beat to death with fists and feet, or more than twice as many people died on bicycles. So I ask these people that want to go after our rifles and, even more importantly, our gun rights, you know, what is your goal? If your goal is to prevent death, then, okay, let's start at the areas where there are significantly more deaths caused by significantly, you know, other items.
And I always worry about when they start talking, you know, they talk semi-automatic, they talk rifle, they talk these big buzzwords, Jim. And the problem is, you say semi-automatic, but the same shotgun that I use to go deer hunting in the fall is semi-automatic. When you start talking these overgeneralized terms, I don't think some of these people realize really what they're talking about.
Oh, no, they know exactly what they're talking about. You've got to learn their tactics. You apply a label to something, it's easy to attack. It's easy to demonize.
Oh, yeah.
Assault rifle. What's an assault rifle? You know, how about an assault 2x4? You know, if I threw one of your little model cars here, threw it at you, is that an assault model? So, to me, none of my firearms are assault firearms. They're all defensive firearms. And it really is that simple. So we have to, I think our side, we do a very poor job of engaging because the people that want to take away our gun rights, you know, first they say they don't. They do. That's their ultimate goal. I mean, study history. You know, history is just full of the ultimate end game of once people start down that path. And that's, again, going back, that's one of the reasons of the Second Amendment. But that's something that we have to be ever vigilant about, is to never, you know, don't go docile and not engage, because they'll come out and then they'll yell and scream and they'll all school shootings, you know, dead children, which is horrible. Horrible. And I hate saying those words, but that is a topic that we're dealing with, because coming off of Parkland, you know, Sandy
right.
Hook happened just a few years ago. Columbine just had their 20-year anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Tech. Okay. All of those schools had something in common. They were all gun-free zones. Okay. Sandy Hook. You know, Sandy Hook was the model safe school of what we're trying to replicate today. You know, we're going to lock the entrances and buzz the doors where you have to get in and out. But I guarantee you, and if you guys are in education, anybody moderately dressed or a student, because we've seen that's who's been doing most of these mm-hmm. shootings, walk up to a door, smile at a kid, and say, hey, let me in. They're going to open that door. Okay, now the shooter's in. Okay, Parkland, what do? He pulled the fire alarm.
Right.
Okay, are we going to do away with fire alarms so they don't do that? No. Can't do that. Okay. Parkland was, I hate to say, it was a perfect example. It was a great learning opportunity of everything that went wrong. What can we do to prevent it again? Okay. Broward County, you know, they were participating in the Promise program, which was a program that President Obama started. They wanted to decrease the arrest rates of minorities. Okay, how do you do that? Well, they found the easiest way. Just quit arresting them for things. Okay. Hey, it looks great on paper.
Right.
But, you know, Ayn Rand, one of my favorite quotes, you know, you can avoid reality, but you cannot avoid the consequences of avoiding reality. So the police had been called to the shooter's residence 39 times in just a few years. Okay, not one of those did they arrest him. Had they arrested him one time, that shooter would have had a record which would have prohibited him from legally purchasing a firearm. Okay, he wasn't in the system. Okay, not only that, the FBI failed not once but twice to follow up on two credible threats. You know, the most egregious one was the shooter himself put on his own Facebook page in his own name. He was wanting to shoot up a school. Then about a month before the shooting, another lady called in with a credible threat. Same name, same threat. FBI did nothing. But then horribly, you know, when the shooter was inside the school shooting, we had police officers waiting outside. And I just saw a thing on Facebook that, as a matter of fact, I shared it. There was another police officer pulled up on scene. There was police hiding behind trees and cars saying, hey, he's inside on the third floor. Now, I cannot process that as a human being, how if that is your, I don't care if it's your job or not. I carry. Okay, it's no secret. I carry. If you know that somebody's inside and every time you hear a shot go off, that's a child being murdered, you run in. As a moral human being, how do you not go into that situation? Okay, but here, you know, we have all this dependency on government to protect us, and government failed at every level at Parkland. Now, what do people come along? They want to make it more difficult for people, for good people, to get firearms, to carry firearms, and they want more government. So on what planet does that make sense?
Let me ask you this, because I'll be interested to hear your kind of take on it. Because I believe, and you'll be able to tell me, Indiana has that same law to where the police can confiscate weapons if they feel that you are a threat. I forget what the law was called in Florida that they didn't enact there, where because of his threats, they could have confiscated his weapons and held them for a time until they finished their investigation. Indiana has that law, am I correct?
Correct.
How do you feel about that?
I like it. You have to be adjudicated. I mean, there is due process. So what's wrong with that? You know, as long as the individual's rights are protected, you know, through the system, and it's above table, that's the way it should be. But again, going back to how many laws were ignored at Parkland?
Absolutely.
So, okay, and again, we have to get away from this mindset that thinking, hey, we need a law to fix this. Laws don't work on people that don't obey laws.
Right.
And laws really don't work if government doesn't employ them. You know, I sponsored a piece of legislation that actually passed a few years ago that provided for a 5 to 20 year sentencing enhancement for certain crimes, for certain gun crimes. Let's get these people off the street. If you prove yourself a threat to society, you don't need to be in society.
Right.
But, you know, if the court system doesn't use those laws, like, we'll plea that down. Well, okay, there's another law, a common sense gun law. You know how many times have we heard that term? We need a common sense gun law. Okay, they're there. They're not being used. They're either not being used or being ignored.
So. Well, one thing I would ask is, being a teacher and educator, I mean, you've talked a little bit about it. What is your thought? I mean, like, as far as protecting schools, and I mean, obviously they've talked about arming teachers and all that kind of thing. Like, what is your thoughts?
I don't want to arm teachers. I want to quit disarming teachers. You guys have constitutional rights. Okay, we know there's school shootings. You get somebody that just doesn't care and wants to make a big name for himself in society, where are you going to go? You're going to go to a school.
Right.
If you want to do something that's vile, despicable, and create a horrible tragedy, you're going to go to a school and you're going to do evil things. Okay, now police aren't first responders. Police in that case are second responders. You know, they get there after the fact.
Right.
So if you, or Dustin, if you, people that choose to, because when you look at Indiana, you can go on the Indiana State Police website, and I think there's over 830,000 Hoosiers that have a license to carry a handgun. Okay? That's basically 1 in 6 Hoosier adults that has a license to carry. So if you're out in public, do a little experiment. Go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carrying, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carrying, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carrying. Okay, we're not seeing the bloodshed. We're not seeing all these gunfights or anything like that. So how is it that all of a sudden people walk across an imaginary line, which is school property,
right,
and they lose their mind? No. And some people say, well, I don't want school teaching. What if a teacher carrying, what if a student attacks that teacher and takes their gun? Okay, are we seeing that with resource officers right now? No. Okay, what about, well, she's a female. Oh, we don't have female police officers? You know, there's some tiny female police officers out there I wouldn't fight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's all attitude. But the thing is, I mean, the NRA has offered to come in. You know, they have a very nice program called School Shield. that they'll come in, do an evaluation, and they'll work with locals. I have talked to literally dozens of very, very good certified NRA instructors that will train teachers for free. But, you know, okay, now let's move past the emotion of that, because that's opinion. Let's look at fact. Okay, now I'm going to round down, just using numbers here, to for easy math, not Common Core, but, you know, regular math.
Yeah.
So, okay, there's over 2,000 schools in the state of Indiana. We're going to round down to 2,000. Okay. A resource officer costs the taxpayer about $50,000 a year. Okay, so simple math, that's $100 million every year to have one armed person standing there. Okay, Columbine had a resource officer. He's human. Kids waited until he went to lunch. Okay. We saw a resource officer at Parkland.
Right.
Okay. I'm not going to pick on him. You know, human being, those things happen.
Yeah.
Okay. But you have one person there. What happens when that one person fails? Or if you have a known resource officer walking around in uniform, guess who's the first target? Somebody committed to murdering children. Okay. Or let's look at Sandy Hook. You know, there were 20 children killed there. There were six females that were there, unarmed, made defenseless by laws, that either rushed the shooter unarmed, or they used their bodies as shields to try and protect children.
Right.
Okay. Imagine if just one or two of them would have had a handgun. You know, now, there is no guarantee. We cannot let zero, we can't let perfect be the enemy, because people say, oh, you know, somebody got shot. Sure, that's life. I'm sorry. Those things happen. But, you know, right after Parkland, there was a shooting in Maryland where there was a resource officer on site that had the mindset to do what he needed to do and save how many lives? You know, there were 17 at Parkland. There were 26 at Sandy Hook. So we don't know. But we know for a fact that had that shooter not been stopped, you know, the casualty count could have been significantly higher and probably would have been. So when I don't want to arm teachers, or I want to disarm you. If you want to carry, I'm going to do everything I can to see that you receive training. And I'm not asking teachers to be SWAT teams either. You know, stay in place, be able to, one, protect yourself and go home to your family that night. Mm-hmm. Two, you'll be able to provide at least a credible defense to save the children in your classroom. Or if you feel comfortable, if you see a shooter in the hallway, take that shot if you feel comfortable. Okay, let's not give you guys 5-gallon buckets of rocks or little mini baseball bats or any of these other insane, I mean, insulting ideas of what we're seeing out there.
Yeah.
You know, and to kind of transition that to another major, you know, topic that you're talking about and getting away from the Second Amendment and our... But actually, you know what? I'm going to pause because I do want to ask you about a piece of legislation that you started with the Second Amendment, and that's the constitutional carry.
Yes.
Where are we at with that? What do you, I mean, are we going to continue to push that situation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as long as I'm up there, it's Constitution. I mean, read the Constitution. It's that simple. I did a little experiment, and you guys being journalists can appreciate this. I actually had an amendment drafted up that took the exact same language that Indiana has recognized to carry a handgun, and I applied that to professional journalists, you know, forcing them to get a license. And that didn't get people talking. But, you know, it did its job because I wanted people to think. And the really neat thing from all over the country, you know, people were writing it. I got drug across the coals, but I loved it. I loved every second of it because it proved my point. Keith Olbermann, you know, that was one of the highlights of my conservative. As a matter of fact, I think I just shared on my Facebook this morning going through a picture. Keith Olbermann called me a sociopath and wanted to run me out of the country. But anyway, my challenge to anybody that disputes that is how is it that we're okay with using that exact same language to license our Second Amendment right, but if we apply it to a First Amendment right, all of a sudden it becomes unconstitutional. And right. nobody has been yet, you know, to explain that to me in a rational, reasonable way. And also, if we accept the licensing of one right, how can you logically sit there and tell me that the rest aren't in danger? So.
Well, and I, you know, and being fully transparent, both of us are, you know, concealed carry permit owners, and for me personally, I have no problem with you knowing that I have that permit. I just don't want to have to pay the money that to
Bingo.
Have my right.
I actually had another amendment drafted that took it even further. If you wanted to vote, go to church, be secure in your home, you know, Fourth Amendment, you had to have a license. Now, as that, actually seeing that in print is the most vile, reprehensible thing you will ever see. Because
I'd say it sounds crazy. It's like, no, what?
It is, but it's in legal form.
Right.
And you look there and you're like, oh, my God. You know, I'm a lawmaker. Okay. We're doing that exact same thing with our Second Amendment, right? Tell me what's different from our first, our fourth, or, you know, our right to vote.
Right, right.
And if we just want to talk about, you know, state funding, I mean, you just said 830,000 people are, you know, concealed carry permit owners. Imagine what you would get if you did enact that. And again, not saying that's what we need to do.
Sure.
But if you just want to talk about the funding of it, if you're going to make the funding off the Second Amendment, you could make a fortune off the other nine.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? And you know, too, that was a legitimate issue, the people that have become dependent upon that funding stream. Last year, I amended a bill that was working its way through the House, and it is law now. It enables every county in Indiana to set up a fund within their LOIT tax to train their local police. You know, because that was where that money was going to. That revenue from the licensing was going to police training. I'm like, okay, legit concern. So we took care of that.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
To move to one of your other major issues, medical cannabis. And Jim, I said this off the air, and I'm going to say it here on the air. You were probably one of the first conservative right-wing Republicans, and I know you said before, and I appreciate it, that you don't like labels, but to really step out of the box and say this is something, especially in the state of Indiana, that we need to talk about is the availability of medical cannabis. Why did you make that decision?
Real quick, this is a long story, but I'll try and give you the short version. Everybody knows last summer when Indiana was going through that CBD issue.
Mm-hmm.
Is it legal? Is it not legal? And next thing you know, we're the laughing stock of the nation. Well, okay, that got me interested, as it should, you know, as a legislator, like, you know, what's going on here? So I started researching and educating myself on the CBD. Well, once I started doing that and I learned about it, you know, that put me in touch. I started reaching out and asking questions, which very quickly, as a conservative Republican, people are like, whoa, you know, this guy's serious. And I knew my stuff through just enough to, you know, get my foot in the door. And so I started learning about it, and the benefits of CBD, what it was doing for people. And once I started talking to people, and y'all, I think you said you were on my Facebook earlier, I keep a public page, and you know, sometimes it can be the Wild West,
but yeah.
It was really cool seeing people, you know, tell me their personal stories. And that I turned that into a little segment. You know, one of my segments is Operation Education. And I throw something out there, and I want you to read it for yourself without any input from me whatsoever. But I started doing From My Fellow Human Being segment. And then I would, you know, put their stories up there. I'd take away their name, you know, and try to, where you couldn't identify them. But it was a personal story. And it was amazing the people that had been helped from this. So once I educated myself on what CBD was, what it did, where it came from. And then I started hearing all these personal stories of people that have been helped by it, people who were weaning themselves off of prescription medications and feeling better and not having the side effects of what they were. It was a no-brainer, you know, from there on out. So I worked on CBD legislation, which I was fortunate enough to be put in touch with one of the leading attorneys in the nation. He actually argued, the person that helped me draft that legislation for CBD, argued the hemp case, the industrial hemp case, before the Ninth Circuit Court. And he's from Denver, Colorado. So, I mean, this guy's top of his game. And
yeah,
was, I'm like, whoa, this is really cool. And so I had there were 10 bills in the State House that dealt with CBD. Mine was the only bill that dealt with industrial hemp, which is where CBD comes from. Okay, I'm like, okay, if we can sell CBD, why can't we grow the plant that it comes from? And when you look at industrial hemp, it's not just CBD oil, but foods. I mean, there's so many nutritious foods you can get out of this. Fibers, industrial uses. You know, Indiana is the number one manufacturing state in the nation, and we're one of the top agricultural states in the nation. We have mm-hmm. Purdue University, who's been growing industrial hemp for years. You know, they are the leading technology university agriculture university on the planet. So I'm like, okay, we have all of these three in our state. This spell's a no-brainer. Okay, but apparently, you know, politics, sometimes the one of the bad things about politics is politics. So politics yeah. got in the way, and you know, we'll shoot again next year for that one. Okay, now back to the medical cannabis. You know, cannabis and industrial hemp are cousins, but they're two completely different plants. In the fact, industrial hemp, you know, according to federal regulations, it is limited to less than 0.3% THC. Okay, you can't help but educate yourself on industrial hemp and then start learning about cannabis. So I'm segueing into your original question now. Once I started learning about that, I'm like, oh, I mean, it was just a whole new world, an epiphany. And hearing more and more stories of even more people that have been helped. Mm-hmm. And again, through my research, I hooked up with some really great people, you know, some people with IndyCan and other people, outside groups. And they set up a trip for me. I went to Illinois. I was the first elected official in the United States to do this trip. I went to Illinois, and I visited a cultivation facility and a dispensary. And Channel 13, Mary Mills from Channel 13, actually... they sent a film crew. She trailed this Wednesday and Thursday, you know, the 2-day trip, and did a documentary on it. But once I got over and saw what they were doing with it and the people that had benefited from mm-hmm. it and how professionally they were handling it. And when you look at the fact there's 29 states that have medical cannabis.
Right.
Okay. Of those 29 states, they've seen an average 25% decrease in opioid deaths. Now, some states have seen a 50% decrease. Now, simple math. Okay, Indiana's seeing about 1,200 opioid deaths a year right now. You know, that's 100 a month. If we were one of those states that saw a 50% drop, that's literally hundreds of lives we could save the first year. Second year, now we're compounding. You know, we're right. talking thousands of lives that could be saved just on that one area. Now, not to mention the people, you know, pain pills. You know, how many people are becoming addicted to opioids through pain medication? And the really neat thing, once this took off, you know, the American Legion is very supportive of this. I got a phone call from a lady one day, identified herself as leader of the National Epilepsy Foundation. She introduced herself and said, "I've heard of your work. How can I help?" You know, the Epilepsy Foundation's behind right. this. It was really cool. There's a website, leafly.com, and I encourage everybody to get on. It's really cool. I mean, one of the many that are out there. But they were out in Washington, and they have a really cool website. People, you know, if they've got anxiety or ADHD or, you know, fibromyalgia, all kinds of ailments, you can go on there and click on, and it's like a, you know, any other site you call in, and people say, give their reviews. Well, I got on their website, I emailed, "Hi, this is State Rep Jim Lucas. I'm from Indiana, trying to bring medical cannabis to our state. You know, here's my cell phone. Can you call me?" About 10 minutes later, I get a call from this company. And they, "Hi, this is so-and-so with Leafly. We've heard about you. How can we help?"
Oh, really?
I'm like, "Where are you guys at?" They said, "We're in Washington State." I'm like, and I started laughing. I'm like, "Okay, have you heard about me?" And he said, "Well, in the industry, Indiana is considered probably one of the most regressive states that will never get medical cannabis."
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, you know, we just got Sunday alcohol sales.
So I know, right? We're moving up in the world.
Hey, well, sadly, I tell people, you know, this is 2018. I've got, 82 years to drag Indiana kicking and screaming into the 21st century. But anyway, he told me about this, and he said, "Through your work, you know, we kept seeing news reports, Indiana, you know, medical cannabis, and it was really amazing because of all the attention." So I'll take this platform and run with it if that's what it takes to benefit people. But one of the coolest parts for me when I went over to Bloomington, I was talking to people, and there was a young couple there in their 40s, and she was a nurse, and she was taking the CBD, but she had, you know, some familiarity with the medical cannabis, you know, through her work as well. But she was telling me, you know, she was been in car wrecks and her body was a wreck, and she's, "I'm in pain constantly, sometimes it's so bad, but I know what these prescription opioids does to your body long term, you know, the toxic side effects right. and addiction, and then you increase tolerance and things like that." So she said, "I only take them when I have to, and when I do that, I'm non-productive." And I started taking some of this, and she said it was really cool because, you know, I could wean myself off the opioids. But she said, "Now I have my life back." I'm like, cool. You know, here's a person that this has affected in a positive way. Her husband's sitting right there, and he goes, I got my wife back. And then it hit me like a two before across the head. I'm like, we just went from one person to two people. And then they both said, our kids got their mother back. So here's a whole family.
Right.
You know, it was affected in a positive way. And so now I'm in. You know, I'm as committed to bringing medical cannabis to this state as I am protecting and advancing our gun rights.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, you brought up the attorney from Denver, Colorado, and the group from Leafly in Washington. Where does do you see it just as medical cannabis, or do you see it to decriminalization and legalization of recreational use as well?
Well, look at what the people want. I mean, you know, let's be honest. You know, we've the war on drugs is gone. We've lost. You know, people say that marijuana, I want to call it cannabis because that's really its name.
That's true.
Right. Cannabis. Yeah. Okay. Cannabis, they call it a gateway drug. No, it's not. You know, I'm Lutheran. I like to drink. I'm not an alcoholic. You know, if there's a gateway drug, it's alcohol. Okay. Now, we have a law. You have to be 21 to drink. How's that working out? Okay. Cannabis is a Schedule I drug. You cannot buy it, but you can get it in almost any middle school across the state, you know, across the country. You can get it in prison. So, you know, let's quit fooling ourselves. Let's be honest and have an honest conversation. You know, these people, that they're going to go out and do things. You know, we've seen what it's done. People, okay, in the absence of cannabis, they're moving on to harder drugs. So it's not the gateway drug. It's the exit drug for a lot of them. And so to answer your question, I'm going at this medical only right now. But when you look around, it's on the ballot in Michigan. You know, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio have medical cannabis right now. Once it gets in there, the two biggest obstacles to cannabis right now is educating people are overcoming the ignorance and stigma. Okay, ignorance, people think, oh, I don't want to smoke a joint out behind the shed in the alley. You know, there's so many ways of administering, you know, THC into your system. There's gummies, vapes, creams. You know, inhalers. There's so many unique ways to get this, I want to call it herbal supplement. You have to be careful calling it medication. You know, getting this into your system and letting it do what it's been doing for thousands of years. You know, mankind's been using this for thousands of years. And you cannot overdose from it. You know, an Israeli researcher in the 90s discovered one of the largest systems in our body is the endocannabinoid system. Okay. Our respiratory or cardiovascular system does not have cannabinoid receptors on it. You can't overdose from it. Now, you can alcohol.
Right.
You go chug a fifth of whiskey. You know, you're either going to die or end up in an emergency room to keep from dying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But yet, you know, we're selling alcohol because we saw that prohibition doesn't work.
Yeah.
So now we either have to, you know, we have to get realistic about it. Okay. And control it the best we can. Or we can keep fighting it, keep spending all this money, you know, paying police officers to arrest otherwise good people, you know, and we take somebody that just wants to ingest a plant to make themselves feel good. So we arrest them and we go put them in a cage with somebody that's murdered, raped, or child molested or something horrible. And we treat them the same. And that's wrong.
And not that it's all about money, Jim, but can we talk about just the fact of what you just said and how much it could flip if you accept it? Because not only do we stop spending the money to chase this and put the money into it, but then you also get the tax revenue of...
Right.
Oh, it's a win-win. Okay, and Michigan saw it. You know, it's on the ballot this fall in Michigan, and it is so popular up there that I've read reports that the Michigan legislature is thinking about putting it in the state house to vote on it, because politicians being the animals that they are, hey, look at me, I voted on something popular, and they'll get the credit for it. You know, Vermont, right now there's 9 states that have recreational cannabis. Vermont was the first state in the nation to vote it in legislatively. And I know it polls extremely well here in Indiana. You know, this is one of the few issues that across the board, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, I mean, I think Republicans are the lowest subset there at 50% or 56%, I think, percent positive. Now you start throwing Democrats and independents in there who are even higher. Mm-hmm. You're in the 70% and 80% positive. Now you show me one other issue.
Oh, yeah.
That pulls that well.
Well, yeah. You said Sunday alcohol sales. Sunday alcohol sales didn't pull as well as what
no.
that does.
Okay. And, you know, we just recently passed that. Has the world come to an end? Did the sun quit coming up, you know? So.
We're about 20, 25 minutes here. We've been doing this, but I do want to give you a chance to talk about, you know, another issue that is one that, and as we talked earlier, you kind of get hung up on, not you, people get hung up on about you, but it's the education issue. And I think that a lot of people see you as an anti-public education legislature. And I want to give you a chance to kind of address that.
Thank you for that opportunity, and thank you both for being educators. And I mean that with every cell in my body. I'm a parent. I went to school. I graduated. My kids went to school. They graduated. They're in college. Who doesn't want their kids educated? But we have to look at the system. I want to say that 1,000 times. Not here, but I want to keep saying it. It's the system. We take great people that want to teach. Now, you guys don't. You didn't get into education for the money.
Right.
Okay.
No.
Okay. You got to, that's what you wanted to do. Okay. Like other people that follow their hearts. That's what they want to do. But government comes in and we put so many shackles on our educators but before we turn around and say, well, why doesn't the state just back off? Well, the state can't. You know, you look at K-12 education, it gets over half of our state budget. Okay. So as a representative of the people, the taxpayers, I am obligated. I have a duty to make sure that that program is ran as efficiently as possible. And that's where the problem is. There is no such thing as a non-bureaucratic, efficient, you know, government program. And when you take government-run education, which is public education, being the largest program, government program we have by far, you're going to have all of those vices that are automatically attached to it that are irremovable. Okay, so what's the best way possible that I see that we can let teachers teach? Okay, and we discussed this earlier, one of the biggest complaints I hear, rightfully so, from teachers, is how can you hold me accountable for this wide array of students coming in here that learn at different speeds, different paces, they have different abilities, different needs, they come from different backgrounds, socioeconomic, the whole gamut. You're right. We can't. And you guys are put in an impossible situation for that. Okay. Who better to choose, though, than the parents? And that's why people say I'm anti-public education. Nothing can be further from the truth. I'm pro-choice when it comes to education. I'm pro-educational choice. Now, parents out there, if they like their public schools, by all means, please keep sending your children there. But in my method, as long as it's in our Constitution that Indiana government has to provide an education, you know, and it has to be equal, I would just as soon put the parents in charge and within that same breath say, let teachers teach and give them the freedom to provide the sort of education that those parents are seeking out for their children. And it really is that simple. But until we can get to that point, we're still going to keep going down this path where, you know, people such as myself, elected officials, who every 2 years, you know, the face changes at the State House.
Right.
So you're going like, okay, what's coming at us this year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're just waiting. We're just waiting for session just to figure out
sure
how we have to adapt and change.
Okay. Now, wouldn't it be great if the parents, okay, you're a math teacher?
Uh-huh.
Okay, awesome. Wouldn't you just love to be able to teach math?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would.
Okay. Now, what if you could teach math the way you want to teach? I went to a seminar one time, and I saw Mr. Khan from the Khan Academy.
Right.
And told about his method, which to me is phenomenal. You know, you're educating children at their pace, and they don't move on to the next step until they've mastered the previous step. Okay. Now, not to say, okay, like right now, we'll take one or two systems and apply that to everybody. Okay, I hate grade-based education. Personally, I hate it because not all 12-year-olds learn at the same pace,
right,
at the same level, at the same speed, with the same method. But you being the expert that you are, you can identify how kids are learning and at what speed. Let you figure that out. You know, who am I to tell you how to do that? But that's the way our system is set up.
Right.
And that's wrong.
Jim, I'm going to... Cal, you got anything else for Jim?
No, I think it's good.
We're at about 40 minutes. We've been in here together. And
it goes
Jim,
fast.
It does.
Before I let you off the hook, I want to ask you one more thing. Again, this is going to come out on Tuesday morning, May 1st. But it's going to be a week away from those primary votes. And I want to give you the opportunity that why on that Tuesday, May 8th, should voters walk in and pick your name?
One, I'm up there to do the right thing. I didn't go up there to be a politician. I got into government because I was upset with how government was functioning. And the best way to fix it is dive in and just, you know, get involved. People know where I stand on the issues. Like I said, I keep an open Facebook page. I don't know how to make myself more accessible or open. I put my cell phone number on my business cards. I'm out and about. I'm a small business owner for 19 years. I take that experience up to the State House. You know, I've been accused of being uncompromising and rigid. You know, as a small business owner, I compromise every day with my customers. Of course, you have to provide them a good product. I have to make a profit. If I don't make a profit, I don't stay in business. Right. I compromise with my employees. You know, there's constant compromises there. So, you know, nothing could be further from the truth there. I have proven myself as having the courage to get in on the very, very tough issues and not just, you know, be a yes vote, but to be a leader. And I think my record speaks for itself right there, and I want to continue that. I'm pushing some very big issues right now that are getting not just state attention, but national attention, and we're making incredible progress, and I want to continue with that. You know, the industrial hemp legislation, I want to get that passed. Of course, the gun rights is always going to be there. And then the medical cannabis. You know, we're really, really close. You know, for a state that just adopted Sunday alcohol sales, for the Indiana House to vote unanimously to do a summer study on medical cannabis is just phenomenal. So I'm very excited about that, and I want to continue with that work.
Well, and I want to say, Jim, and you brought up that, you know, people may see you as rigid, but I want to thank you, first of all, because, you know, we're a small-time podcast out of Crothersville, Indiana, and it's a passion for my wife and I, and we reached out to you in an email, and you immediately responded and said, heck yeah, I'll drive down and come on. And I appreciate that. I appreciate you coming on to kind of give your views of the issues. And no matter what, and we kind of gave both candidates, I know there's a third that we didn't get on, but we gave you and Nancy an opportunity to come on here. No matter what, to all of our listeners, what I would like to say is on May 8th, get out and vote. No yes. matter where you fall, both candidates got an opportunity to speak, but get out and vote and get yourself in the polling situation and use your rights to actually choose who is running the, you know, government, because that's as important as anything else we have.
Absolutely.
No, I appreciate you coming on. I really do appreciate, especially like you said, you know, all the hot button issues, and you aren't afraid to, you know, say, hey, this is where I stand. This is what I, whether it's the popular thing or not. And so as just a, I mean, I appreciate that from all different aspects. So,
well, the thing, and I want to make it clear, I do listen. But, you know, I'm not afraid to give my opinion where I stand on the issue. And I tell people that, you know, this is where I stand. This is why I stand. Prove me wrong. And if you can prove me wrong, I'll be the first person to say, hey, I was wrong. Yeah. You're right. Now, you know, let's team up and go push this issue. But I do, I think, a very good job of, I try to anyway. Let me back up.
Yeah.
It doesn't always come across.
That's fair.
But no, I'm open. And you know, I make myself accessible and I'm very passionate about the issues. And sometimes that comes across as being, you know, pushy, but I consider it passion.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you, and I wish you all the best of luck in the May 8th primary, and after that, on to the actual November election, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Yes,
my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.